Open lines next hour, including an amazing theme, things that have happened to you that you've witnessed that are simply amazing. They could be tragic. They could be miracles. Whatever they might be, why don't you share those with us in addition to open lines. We're going to come back in a moment to chat more with David Cerita and take your calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back with David Cerita. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll get to your calls in a second here. So, David, have you developed your own technology to try to communicate with the ETs?
Yes, I definitely have. And there are many people, you know, who buy and use these devices from my website for many, many years. And I get amazing letters from people, George. I mean, astounding, that, you know, proving I'm not the only one who's having these experiences. And basically, the idea of quantum communication comes from experiments by Einstein, noting that even biological systems, like a mother and a baby rabbit, are electro. You know, they hook up their brains to electroencephalograms, mm-hmm. and they separate them over great distances, and they'll pinprick the baby, and the mother brain will impulse with the signal of the pain in the baby faster than light and instantaneously. So that leads eventually to Fritz Albert Popp's work with plants, where he measures, and this is a real, you know, qualified German physicist who proves that plant and human auric light emissions, light coming off of plants and humans, travels instantaneously or faster than the speed of light. I mean, you don't know ultimately how fast it's going until you test it with a distant star system. But what determines communication between two points is the wave functions. And frequency is one of those wave functions. And if you know the radius of a distant star, it's easy to calculate its frequency, which I did. And then because it's a sphere, you can, like a music scale, you can spherically, what's called, scale those frequencies. And part of those frequency bands end up in the audible range of the human ear. And the lower bands end up in the delta, theta, and delta bandwidth of the human nervous system. So the human nervous system is fully capable of tuning itself to the frequency of a planet or a star. For example, when we dream, our brain is in theta, and the frequency of Earth at the equator is in theta. You know, the Tesla-Schumann resonance is in the theta part of the brain where we dream. So theoretically, we dream at the frequency of our planet. So I began to wonder what would happen if I electrically, using what I use these things called vortex mantra coils that are wound at the angle of the Great Pyramid.
Vortex mantra coils.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you put them under your bed. And strange enough, I actually did this when NASA had the recent satellite going by Pluto. When it was approaching Pluto, I calculated the frequencies of Pluto, ran them through the coil, and I instantly remote viewed so clearly. It's not like I'm imagining this. You're lying there in the remote viewing state where you're receptive, but you don't project any images, and you just wait. And suddenly, I was on the far side of Pluto looking back towards the sun, and I said, Pluto has an atmosphere. I said, that's impossible. It's an ice ball. How could it have an atmosphere? Well, 3 days later, when the satellite passed Pluto and was looking back towards the sun, it had an atmosphere, to their surprise. So I knew that the idea of using frequencies to remote view absolutely makes sense. It works. And then when the signal numbers came in from the star we're talking about tonight, I converted those to through the coil, so you don't hear them, but they go in a magnetic wave, the electrically inductor transfer to my electrical nervous system. And it didn't take long, and I was there and saw the transmitter, and this was before I even read the SETI article. I hadn't even read the SETI article that there were two possible ways ETs could have sent this signal. And I saw this massive transmitter floating out in space with these giant spherical metallic balls and this glass dome structure space station where the operator was. And they couldn't optically see our planet, but they literally sent this signal in a beam, a huge energy beam. However, the quantum part of the wave is the part that goes faster than light. The rest of the wave arrives 94.4 years later. So the question is, did the signal we get, the very weak signal we get, is that the end of the train, whereas the brunt of the wave, which is the quantum function,
or the beginning?
Did it get here a long time ago? I mean, did it already get here 94 years ago, and we're just getting the tail end of it now? Because that's what the data shows at Princeton and at Berkeley on these faster than light.
Well, let me ask you this, though, David. One of the Seth Shostak's concerns last night was that the signal did not repeat itself. It seems to be a one-time burst. And he says with that, he's convinced that it's some kind of terrestrial interference.
No, see, that I when you understand, like, say, here's a great experiment. William Tiller, this is in one of my films, Quantum Communication. And I interviewed William Tiller, who's a material scientist, you know, at Stanford University years ago. And he does these experiments where he takes fruit fly larvae and he encodes it with intention, thought, to raise the pH value in a glass of water 6,000 miles away. Now, this transmitter is a living fruit fly, living transmitter, sends the information from inside of a bunker through, you know, many, many feet of concrete, and it has to go through mountain ranges and everything to get to its target. And sure enough, it raises the pH of the water, and it takes about 30 days. But then he tells it to lower the pH of the water, and it does lower the pH of the water, so there's no accident. Now, if you were sitting in with your cell phone using radio waves, and you had your cell phone would get blocked by even a parking garage. Even that much concrete will block your cell phone.
So I've had that happen a lot.
Right. So imagine you're sitting on this star with this massive transmitter, and you send the signal five times. But some of those signals crash into asteroids, and look at the not only the asteroid belt, but the Oort cloud where all the ice chunks are in the outer rim of the solar system. I mean, how many signals are going to bounce off all that stuff? And how weak will the signal when it gets through be? So maybe they did send it 20 times, but only one of it made through all that in its timing. And I'm not just talking about the defense of the Oort cloud and the asteroid belt. I'm talking about all of the different debris fields in between that star and us. So that's assuming the light speed slow part, the wider wave function. But the quantum function is the reason I believe we got hit by the end of the train is the wavelength of this signal is 2.5 centimeters, 11 gigahertz, so you're in the gigahertz band. But that doesn't mean it's not even higher frequencies than that. We don't have the ability to even see a signal in the tetrahertz range, for example. We don't even know how to do that yet, so we don't even know if part of the signal was tetrahertz.
David, if we got hit with the latter part of the signal from 90-some years ago, they might have already been here then by now.
They might have, and you like these UFOs, like I'm saying, they don't use these huge amounts of energy to get here because we would see it, and that's why most physicists don't believe UFOs are real. And we know that they're real. I mean, I've seen one with my own eyes, and when you see one with your own eyes, in fact, even recently, I mean, here's a story in our family. My little daughter, Alira, who's turning 6 soon, this October, last Valentine's Day, she woke up the next morning, and she saw a golden ball of light as big as a beach ball come into her room. The curtains were blowing around. All the toys were and papers were blowing out in her room, and she said, "Daddy, I mean, I'm clutching the blankets, and I'm shaking." And I said, "Why didn't you wake me up? Why didn't you come and get me?" And she said, "I was too scared." And she wouldn't sleep in her room for months after that. But it was a golden ball of light. The point is, it seemed real to her. It was blowing the curtains around. She could see it. It got here. Where's it from? And how do they do it? And why don't we see these things? Well, I have this little, anyone can buy one of these from Alpha Labs. You get these tri-field meters. And you turn it to radio microwave, which measures watts per meter squared, which is, you convert a Jansky to watts per meter squared. And the strongest part of the meter will register at 1 full watt per meter squared, which is, you know, countless Janskis. So I turn it on. It has an alarm, so the alarm will squeak when it goes off. And when we were living in Sedona, and I believe that I was being, you know, watched by military, the meter would just go off all the way to the end, at the end of the, in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. And I'd get up and look at it and say, well, there's no way that's an ET signal because that's way too strong. This is obviously something local, and it's obviously beamed at our house because there's no way a signal would be this strong, a full watt per meter squared, all over the place.
Right.
And that would happen periodically. And so one of the reasons we left Sedona and came here. The point is that these meters are so sensitive. They start at 0.1 or 1/100th of a watt per meter squared, this particular meter. And one day I was walking around Sedona, and it was pulsing at the low end of the spectrum. Every so many seconds, the meter would just pulse all over Sedona. Didn't matter where I was.
Huh.
So, again, those are way stronger pulses than this 0.75 Jansky signal we're talking about.
How easy is it, David, for a civilization many millions of light years away to be able to determine whether there's intelligent life on another far-off planet, like looking at Earth? Could they tell without getting here?
You see, that's why quantum sensors are the next generation transistors. And you can see this on what are called DNA transistors. And that's when you connect DNA, living transmitter receiver material, to an actual transistor so you can amplify that ultra-weak living signal. And there's news of this all over the place out there. And that is where you get into merging consciousness or AI with technology, and that's how you would know. So you can know multiple ways. One, all sentient living electrical beings dream, so we dream at different bandwidths of frequencies, and therefore if you know the wavelength of a certain star or planet, you could send a signal there on that wavelength and that planet or star, because you can calculate these things with good telescopes. NASA uses a system called parallax to get the radius of a distant star or planet. And therefore, if you sent information, the beings in that planet might dream of the information you're sending them. And because that's the quantum function of the brain. In fact, even Fritz, his name was Claude Montagnier, a French virologist who won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of the AIDS virus. He did these later experiments.
Frick.
Crick was the discoverer of DNA, but Fritz, no, this guy is the French virologist.
That's all right. Go ahead.
He did experiments. Luc Montagnier did experiments with DNA to see if it could read signals of very low wavelengths, because the wavelength of DNA is so tiny. I mean, you're talking about a signal from this star at 2.5 centimeters. Think of how small your DNA wavelength is. But he sent signals equal to the frequency of Earth, Luc Montagnier did, at human DNA, and it read it. Oh, my God, you mean your DNA, this little antenna in the middle of all your cells, can read ultra-slow wavelengths? And he found, yes, it can. And it can do even more amazing things than that. It can clone information. So therefore, if your DNA can read an ultra-low signal, then it could definitely pick up ultra-weak signals that are intentionally set at our solar system. It's possible when this signal arrived, people had amazing dreams, you know, last May. I mean, that would be an interesting study to do. It's possible that it is just a natural harmonic that just came from somewhere near that star, but not exactly that star. But it's possible it came from an alien spacecraft that's nowhere near that far away, too. That's just in that direction of the radio telescope pointing there. There's too many possibilities, but the fact that I've proven it's at a harmonic begs me to believe that the deeper research needs to be done into this thing. There could be information, just like pictures and images and television and voices can be pulse modulated onto light waves. There could be more subtle information in this wave, and I'm sure the Russians are looking at it. The fact that it took them a whole year to get to us is absolute proof to me that they've known for a year that this thing was not satellite interference. I mean, they're too smart to know that. This news report coming out is trying to block it. It's trying to throw a punch at it and say, don't look at it anymore. We didn't really want you to take it all over your media. We just, you know, had somebody at SETI look at it, and somebody leaked the story out.
All right, David, let's take a call or two, and then we'll take a break and come back with final calls. We'll go to Leroy in Hudson, Kansas. Hi, Leroy. You're on with David Cerita.
Hello, George. I've been listening to you for years.
Well, thank you, sir.
Okay, Wednesday night, I was about 10 o'clock at night. I was looking out of the door to the west, and I saw this bright light that was low. It was below the cloud, and it was heading east. The light flashed once, and it started making a gradual turn to the north. The light flashed again, and about then it was...
Not like a plane, was it?
No, it was not like a plane, and there was no other lights on it. It was only in sight about 15 seconds, and the light flashed only three times in that time.
David, what do you think of something like that? People are,
well,
people
know,
are
light
seeing things.
Phenomena at night, I mean, it can be a number of things, and it can be a UFO. I mean, RFA requires us to have these flashing lights, so all aircraft have to have them.
Right,
so,
but we should have seen more lights than just one, right?
Well, if it was an FAA, you know, registered flying vehicle, it would have the FAA lights on it, and if it doesn't,
right, then
that's suspicious for sure.
David, since you've been doing this and investigating this, do you think this planet is being watched?
Monitored? Absolutely. You know, see, the question of when we say, is it evil, or are they coming here to take our planet?
David Jacobs thinks they are.
See, that's the mentality of a consciousness and a race of extraterrestrials who don't have access to all the planets out there. And you think of all the real estate and all the planets out there that the Creator created, it's not like there's not enough real estate and not enough resources. People tend to go to war over a lack of resources. So, but let's say that there's not enough water on a lot of planets, that, and we have water, and there are other beings that require water to live, then they might be interested in our water, right? But I think there are probably too many. Once you reach the point that you can go interstellar, then that's still not that impressive, because you know, you may be able to reach a few different stars, and you find out those stars don't have any water.
Right.
But when you get to the point that you can span a galaxy, you wouldn't be interested in war anymore. And most of the cases of UFOs do not show evidence of any craft being weaponized by any type of a weapon that's obvious to us that can physically obliterate a city or even a town.
I mean, like the movie Independence Day, they could blow us right out of the off the planet. We'll be back. And welcome back. Our final segment with David Cerita. Next hour, open lines begin. Let's go to Sherry in Memphis, Tennessee, east of the Rockies. Hi, Sherry. Good morning.
Hi. I love your program. It's very interesting.
Thank you.
What I want to say is I used to work for some physicists under Dr. Van Allen, who had contracts with NASA to listen to the sounds of space. And I know there are sounds of space, like a hiss, a B.O. of hiss.
Mm-hmm.
And other sounds that they were recording, listening to figure out. But this is so, what he did in his test is so beautifully harmonic that I don't think an extraterrestrial or a human being could make such a beautiful sound. We don't know any way to do it. And I think this had to be one of two things. Either it's the interaction of a creation of God and the stars and in the universe, or it's a sound put out by God because...
Like angels or something.
Well, it says at the end times that there will be signs in the sky, and it doesn't have to be something we see. It can be things that we hear. And I think It could be either one because it's so beautiful and perfect.
Well, that's an interesting take, sure. Let's get David's thoughts on that. David, what if it's done somewhat angelic?
Well, see, I just did a calculation where I added all the... See, what she's talking about is the video, which is linked on the Coast to Coast
right.
website, where I convert the wavelengths to millimeters, and, you know, I measure them in millimeters, and then I convert those to tones in a tone generator, and she's right. It's so beautiful, the tones going up on the left side. And when I add all the numbers up on the left side, it comes to the number 1700. And 17 is message from God in ancient Hebrew gematria. And the ratio of the right side and the left side is a ratio to 1 to 1.1. And that's the ratio of the numbers on the right side, 1 to 1.1 and 1 to 2.2, which is... The fact that the ratio on the left, that all the numbers on the left side and all the numbers on the right side are the same ratio as the numbers between themselves on the right side and the 1 to 2.2 is just a double of that. I mean, that's just mind-blowing stuff. But what she's talking about is the pure beauty in what you experience with these wavelengths converted to tones. Now, if I blew my model up even bigger, the ratio between those tones stays the same. I actually tone tested it by moving the decimal over, so I shrunk it by a factor of 10, and it's still beautiful. It's just a little bit slower. Now, if you look at the jagged lines of the background of space and what she's talking about, recordings done of the sounds of space, she's right. A lot of those sounds are pretty chaotic and distorted. They're not beautiful and perfect like these wavelengths are, and that is very interesting.
Next up, we go to Martha in Healdsburg, California, west of the Rockies. Hi, Martha.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Well, I used to be a flight attendant with Flying Tigers, and we flew in and out of Vietnam. And one night, when we went out of Anchorage, Alaska, it was about 4 hours out, one of the military men rang his bell. And I went over there, and he said, "Excuse me, ma'am, what is that?" It was a pretty quiet night. Everybody was sleeping, and this guy was wide awake. And I looked out, and there was this huge thing out in front of the window. And I said, "I don't know." I said, "Let me go up and see the captain." And I walked up, and the captain was talking to Pan Am. And Pan Am said, "It's solid." And the captain said, "Are you going to report it?" And they said, "No." And I said to them after, I said, what was that? And he said it was a UFO.
Wow. That's a great story.
And that was it.
That is a great story. Thanks for sharing that with us, Martha. Oh. Those stories, those airline stories, David, are some of the best.
Yeah, I think testimony like we just heard is far more valuable than a YouTube video is. I mean, I really appreciate hearing real testimony, and it's absolute proof that they're doing it, but they're not doing it on this massive energy scale, like, you know, according to our crude rocket science and physics. And actually, George, when you look at the numbers on the left side of the wave all added up to 1700, 17 times the Trinity, or 3, is 5-1. And 5-1 is the Great Pyramid Angle, and it's also the true length. You think of the Ark of the Covenant and how Moses used it to telecommunicate with God. And, you know, in our new book, God's Great Pyramid, which is, you know, right on the front page of our website there, the true length of the Ark of the Covenant is proven to be 51.5125 inches, and 5151 is the slope angle of the Great Pyramid, and that ties the
arc
of Moses to the Great Pyramid. And therefore, actually, one thing we also have done just recently is we've made a xylophone toning bar at that length, and miraculously, I got a meter to measure the frequency of the wavelength of the Ark of the Covenant tone bar, and the type of aluminum I picked out, it's ringing at 151, which reads 5151 either way, left or right. It hertz. So What's amazing about these numbers on this spike coming from this star is 390 millimeters plus 530 plus 780 add up to 1700. And 17 is the building block of the 5-1, because 17 times 3 is the 5-1. And in ancient Hebrew, 17 does mean message from God. Now, does that mean the signal is coming from God? I tell you, I don't know, but I'm seeing math here. I mean, I've been doing nothing but math and harmonics and converting frequencies and numbers in the Great Pyramid to tones and the most perfect music scale is the most perfect music scale in existence, which is proven in my video, the scale of life, is the 5-1-5-1 scale. And so when you see numbers on this star, you know, imprint coming in on the Russian telescope, and I'm, again, it doesn't matter how I blow up or shrink this model, the ratios don't change. But the scale that I blow it up to in millimeters, it adds up to 1700, 17, the building block of the 5-1. So, and the ratios on left and right side are phenomenal. Phenomenal. There's no way this is an accident. This is so intelligent. There's no way it's some Russian military satellite. I just can't believe that.
Next up, Randall is truck driving somewhere in Indiana. Hi, Randall.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Good, sir.
I've been listening to you for a few years, and I love the show. I appreciate what you
Thank you.
I have a question when it comes to consciousness and the correlation with numbers. You were talking about above gigahertz earlier, and I was wondering if you think maybe consciousness that we have in ourselves and other beings out in space, they would have a higher frequency of consciousness that would relate to their star. And if we was to leave from our solar system, would our consciousness change?
Well, that's a phenomenal question. See, basically the way telepathy works, I believe, is very similar to how radio works. If we all listen to the same song together, which has musical notes of varying frequencies, we're all vibrating to those same frequencies. So when everybody was listening to the Beatles when they first came out, we're all vibrating at the same wavelengths and frequencies. So we're all communicating telepathically. So you change frequency based on what you're being exposed to, either through sound or inductance, electrical inductance to the nervous system and the DNA. And therefore, if you can start vibrating, like why did Moses, for example, why did God tell him to make the ark this length, which we prove is 51.51? All you got to do, in Peter Lemizuri's book, The Great Pyramid Decoded, there are 14 or 15 places in the Great Pyramid where two royal cubits equals 41.21 inches. So half of that is a true cubit, 20.605. So God says, make the ark 2.5, it would be royal cubits because we know that in the Bible, then that's 51.5125, because 20.605 inches is a true cubit, so royal cubit. So therefore, the length of the arc, I've actually calculated its actual electromagnetic frequency, and the actual electromagnetic frequency of the arc is the most astounding number. But even doing, my new, Ark of the Covenant toning bars, we've done all the dimensions of the arc in toning bars, produces the most beautiful, beautiful sounds. So why did Moses' staff and his brother's staff and the 12 tribes' staffs fit in the length of the ark? Because the staffs were all that long. Now, if you think of a staff as an antenna, in which I think is half a wavelength, I can't remember, there's a simple formula for how high an antenna has to be to pick up a certain frequency. You can therefore understand that there's a harmonic reason for this 5-1-5-1 math in the Great Pyramid. Stonehenge is sitting at 51 degrees, 1 minute north latitude. Area 51 got its name. There's 50 states in the United States, and the 51st state is hidden as the District of Columbia. So you see this number, 5-1-5-1, everywhere. In fact, there's way more places than even that it exists in history that we've documented in the new book, God's Great Pyramid. So I believe it's a number as a frequency. And so therefore, you think of when if we're all vibrating to these 5-1 harmonics, which which we have now, then where does that put us in our consciousness? And I'm just having, and my wife is having, and our children are having astounding, and so are the people who are taking our toning courses, astounding experiences working with these particular frequencies. we have barely begun to scratch the surface in music on our planet to understand that there are multiple hidden perfect harmonic scales in the universe. We only listen to music with these 12 tones, only 12 tones. Like there's no other tones in existence. You can only listen to these 12 tones in your guitar, your piano, your harp, whatever. So these ETs send a signal with a series of tones that are perfectly harmonic, as the last caller described when you listen to them, but they're not part of our music scale. They're not part of anything we know. And their ratios or octave shifts are different than ours, but they're perfect. They work. So that tells us that vibrationally, like the last caller said, if we went to another star, would we vibrate at a different frequency? You would. Of course you would, because that star is a different size, different wavelength, and you would start vibrating at their wavelengths, and you would start, you know, telepathic communicating
with
them.
So you think we're being communicated with, don't you?
I think we are. I think a lot of people's experiences behind sleep are genuine, true quantum communications with different beings. And I think, you know, the highest beings in the universe are the super angelic and God and all of that. I mean, those are the highest vibrational beings. Those are the beings that can transverse any distance in the universe in zero time, the singularity, when you reach absolute universal singularity, not just a black hole singularity. And what Carl Sagan does in the end of the book Contact, by having the whole group, they pass Vega. You know, in the movie, when, you know, she's looking down and she sees that city down there, that's actually Vega, but she passes that.
She passes
she
that
her
up,
dad.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's actually supposed to be in the book, the singularity in the center of the black hole in the middle of the Milky Way, and that's where they go in the end. But it's not just her, it's this whole group, and they're literally meeting, you know, you don't use the word God, but you're meeting the highest intelligence in the galaxy in the center. And, you know, there, I believe, are higher and higher vibrational galaxies. You know, you eventually graduate from the harmonics of your own local solar system, and you go into higher and higher planets, which are documented in all the world religions, and eventually you probably go, as an individual light being, you probably go to a higher and higher level galaxy, and that's what the Urantia, you know, talks about.
Let's go to Bob in New Jersey. Hey, Bob, go ahead.
Hello, George. Hello, David. Another great show. I wanted to ask David, you just mentioned that your DNA are actually antenna, and medical researchers have found recently that as you age, your telomeres shorten and your DNA gets shorter. I have two questions. The first one is, do you think our cells die because the antenna stop working because they get shorter, and that's what causes cancer and other degenerative diseases? And then my second question, you may have talked about it, I missed the beginning of the show. Can these sounds and frequencies be used for healing? Do you have any info on that?
Well, absolutely. See, distortion, if you put your chakras or your energy centers on top of an xylophone and you see my video, you know, the scale of life, and you hear the tones in our music scale, there's a distortion. And distortion is caused when waves crash into each other. Our music scale doesn't distort badly, actually. The worst scales I've heard are the 444 scale and the 432 scale. Now, 432 itself as a single frequency may be very beneficial, but there is no complete scale there. The pyramid scale, which I believe is the pyramid of is the music scale of the angels and God, because we can prove, actually mathematically, and as Peter Lamazurier tried to do years ago, that the Great Pyramid is actually designed by the God of the ancient prophets. And so therefore, the music scale in the pyramid is God's musical scale, and those tones we now have available for everyone. So what happens is when tones are moving through your body and there's distortion between one tone and the next, the energy isn't flowing correctly. And with the pyramid scale or God scale, there's the purest sound in between each note. So therefore, the energy flows much more perfectly as a full spectrum resonator, which we are living, you know, copies of God. Therefore, we're much more likely to activate our light body with the proper tones. In the Gospel of the Egyptians, Jesus clearly adheres to the ancient Egyptian toning system of using your voice to chant vowel tones with the right pitch to activate the light body, which is an ancient Egyptian practice which Jesus was continuing in the Gospel of the Egyptians. And in fact, the name of God, the true name of God from the most ancient sources are pure. And in the Hebrew system, it's the Tetragrammaton, the four letters that you don't pronounce. But Peter Lemizurier documents that the Hebrews got the Tetragrammaton, the four letters, the Yahweh, from Hufwa, which is an Egyptian word, which means the same thing as the Hebrew word. It just means I am that I am, which is what the burning bush told Moses. I am that I am, the pure I am that I am, universal presence, self, that permeates all of existence. But that actually, that I am that I am, is the culmination of a series of perfect pitch tones. In the pyramid scale, in the math in the pyramid, I've decoded 360 tones, three scales, a minor, a mid, and a major scale, and all of those tones, as they ascend, do not distort, which is utterly astounding, because our music scale doesn't have anywhere near that many tones, and our music scale distorts slightly. Our music scale is pretty good, but it distorts slightly. But I think, as this signal has demonstrated tonally, there are probably hundreds of actually perfect tonal scales mathematically that we just haven't found because nobody's interested.
Well, let's hope, David, that we get a little bit more information about this signal. And again, the Russians think it was terrestrial. David Cerita says, no way. Up next, those open lines.